Hello, heroes, and welcome to Backstory. I'm your host, Alex Roberts. Heroes, I'm recording from the road again. And this time, I'm in sunny Oakland, California for Big Bad Con 2017. Huge thanks to everyone at Big Bad Con for having me out as a guest this year. If you're in town for the con, please do find me and come and say hi. I would love to meet you. My guest today is Darcy Ross, writer, designer, noted gastropod enthusiast, brilliant scientist, and community relations coordinator over at Monte Cook Games, in addition to being the co-host of the CypherSpeak podcast. There were so many reasons to have Darcy on the show, but to me the biggest one is that she kind of embodies the best, most positive way of being a fan of something, and I really wanted people to hear what that sounds like. Also, I wanted to learn a lot about snails, and I did, so let's jump right in. Okay, so what are the, what's the snail presence in Numenera? When are we going to see this sort of mollusk expansion? I have a lot of questions.
Oh, man. They're already there. So, yeah, and that's one thing that attracted me to it, too, is there's all sorts of, they've got a very good sense of the mollusk diversity that one would hope would be present in a million years. So... and I think there's like a snail wrangler somewhere in one of the books that's named after me, which is very charming. So they're doing it. They're doing right by me and my snails.
Okay, so where are snails in however many eons?
Oh, man. Well, there's lots of marine snails, so in the oceans. But there's also these great like bivalves that have, colonized asteroid belts.
Oh.
So they're pretty fabulous because they can kind of clamp down into their little bivalve shell and protect themselves from the harsh external environment. There's also octopi play a pretty big role in the deep oceans of the Numenera's ninth world. And I think the premise is that they've probably stuck around all through the billion years and are just this ancient, awesome, weird community of great mollusk intelligences. So it's pretty great.
That makes perfect sense. I watched a science fiction nature documentary once, and its sort of end conclusion was like, and then a billion years later, octopi were the dominant species on Earth. Bye.
Oh, man, I'd believe it. It's very impressive, though. Squids are like, octopus really have that down. Cuttlefish are very charming, but cuttlefish and squid are way less bright, and lots of mollusks like snails are just dumb as rocks. darling, dumb as rocks.
Unintelligent does not mean not delightful and adorable.
Exactly. They have lots of value as little organisms.
Yay. What's the most recent thing you learned about snails so that I can also learn it?
Ooh, that's a really good question. I learned a ton about snails that blow my mind. Okay, so there are these really bizarre species of snails that are a marine and they float around in the water column. Like, gosh, I think I'm trying to like narrow in on which level of story I want to tell you. But there are some really bizarre marine snails that have internalized their shells, which is already pretty weird. But they turn them into these really, really crazy shapes. Where they kind of look like little spaceships, and they're almost unrecognizable as a snail. And I'm so bad, and I can't even think of what their name is. They blow my mind, though. I'll have to feed this into you later, so you can put it in the show notes or something. But they are the most baffling snail I've ever seen. Their fleshy bits aren't even really recognizable as like. A gastropod is like a stomach and a foot, right? Like,
yeah.
That's how you make a snail. You got a big old muscular foot to squick around on, and you got like stomach and innards to eat things with.
Mm-hmm.
That's the recipe for a snail. And like, I look at this creature and I can't recognize the shell. I can't recognize the foot, and I can't recognize like literally any of the other organs. Can't see a head. And it's just this Lovecraftian darling floaty translucent horror.
Mm-hmm.
And it's especially cool because like I study snail shells. And one of the things that really excites people about snail shells, or some people, is how they tend to be mathematically regular. You know, you get this like beautiful Fibonacci spiral, right? You get that regular coiling. And so, you know, lots of snails have done variations on that kind of shape, but this is really thrown out the entire plan for what a shell looks like. And so I don't even know how to map a snail that exists that looks like that onto like what that means for the rest of snaildom, right? So that totally blew my mind the other day.
Oh, whoa. Someone who's just reinventing the genre.
Absolutely. And I wonder, you know, maybe it'll be really successful. In a billion years, will we see that kind of reinvention of the snail? Will that be what, will that be, have an evolutionary advantage? And that's kind of the diversity of snails we'll see in the future. It's kind of hard to tell because so many are dying out right now. Their snails tend to be pretty endangered.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's really sad. They're crazy diverse. They've got, they're over, goodness, what are the numbers up to these days? They're second only in species number to like arthropods. So like, you know, insects and things like that. Mm-hmm. So mollusks are super, super diverse. And all these snails, I think, are, you know, they tend to get really small. And so I think they colonize these little locations and these little niches. And they're kind of tied to a water source usually. So there are these amazing like Malaysian land snails that are super duper duper tiny, almost barely can't see them. And they've got really wild shell morphologies. And I think as those little ecosystems are kind of drying up, as like climate change happens, it's just wiping out all of these species probably faster than we're discovering them, which is pretty sad.
Wow.
So there's lots of change happening in the snail world right now.
Yeah, wow. And I mean, we must be seeing all kinds of strange adaptations to a lot of those changes as well. I mean, not as fast as the changes are happening, but still.
Oh, absolutely. There's a ton of cool experiments with, you know, these shells tend to be calcium based is how they build their little protective shell. And, you know, calcium is in the ocean seawater and it's reacting with all of these other chemicals. And there's been a lot of questions about how acidification in the ocean will change, like how well shells are able to be made, and will species die out because they just can't build a shell to protect themselves with anymore. And something that's, you know, I think the answer to most big scientific questions like that are, you know, the answer is like, well, sort of, right? It's sort of true, but it's sort of not. So some species are really getting, you know, when you raise them in pH that is changing like it will for climate change, even at pretty low levels, they get holes in their shells and they're generally weaker. And so that could be a real problem. But some species are totally not having that problem. So I think it opens up a whole new door to like, okay, what's different about these two snails that we humans are like, ah, snail's a snail, shell's a shell. There's something different going on. And I think understanding that can really help us figure out what species we need to really worry about, like working really hard to conserve, right? Because it's kind of overwhelming to think about, like, you know, we humans would like all the species that we currently know and love to stick around, but like, that's too many to focus our efforts on. So, mm-hmm. you know, that whether you focus on who's more endangered or who's more fluffy and charming and charismatic, there's a lot of questions to guide that, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I mean, is there an aspect to that question as to like what role that certain organisms play in the ecosystem as well? Because I imagine there's kind of a domino thing when a species goes extinct, right?
Absolutely. You know, you think about coral bleaching, right? Like when corals go bad, they're the substrate on which all of these other animals are living. And you know, once a coral goes down, it's taking all of the other animals are sort of built up on top of it, down with it. So, I think that's definitely one thing people try to optimize for, but that requires knowing a lot about the biology. And so we tend to get surprised a lot about things we didn't think were important, but might be. And kind of conversely, you know, I work in sort of experimental genetics a little bit, right? So I tinker with genes and see what happens in the shell. And one thing that people are talking about a lot lately is like, mosquitoes are big vectors for disease, right? They're a huge problem for human health and other, you know, other animal health. So like the question has been raised very seriously, like, would we be okay if there just weren't mosquitoes anymore, right? So, you know, bats tend to eat them, but there are other things for bats to eat. Like, could we get by if we just killed all the mosquitoes, and then we wouldn't have to deal with, you know, malaria as much and things like that. So I think we now have the tools to do really crazy changes like that. And I think I don't think anyone has really gone through with any big sort of big scale changes like that, but it's within our grasp, which is wild.
That is wild. And that's really sort of frightening to think of humans messing with the ecosystem at that level. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, when we make changes that are that big, they're not usually very good.
Yeah. Yep.
But at the same time, I don't live in a place that is like ravaged by malaria. So it's, right. I don't know if I can just sit there and be like, no, I don't know. Is it above man's station to do such
great
things?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, there's so many unknowns right now, but I don't know. And with CRISPR and gene editing in humans, like, you know, that question that has been raised by sci-fi for so long, we actually have to now contend with it. Like, what will we allow to modify in offspring? Is it only going to be, you know, conditions that are going to be, you know, kind of fatal for the child or for the mother? Or is it going to be, can you get, you know, the eye color you want? Mm-hmm. Where do we draw those lines? We now have that power. So that's really scary and interesting too.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, I know. It's a wild world. Like, and, you know, I've been in a PhD program for 5 years, and how much has changed in those 5 years is really impressive too, which is slightly depressing because, you know, if I were studying my PhD now, I would do totally different techniques to try and answer this question. So you feel so dated by the time you do anything. I suppose the tech world knows that too, right?
Oh, yeah, I guess so. What is the question?
Ooh, the question. Good question. So I'm really fascinated by, you know, the idea that in all of our many cells, there exists this little nucleus that contains the instructions for building all of me, right? I think that's, you know, that's where I just am kind of jaw-droppingly impressed that the instructions for building a whole complex human with all these behaviors and shapes and like processes like that all gets boiled down into our DNA. And so I've always been really fascinated by how different animals look too. Like, I just think like looking at animals and plants and the diversity of life is super, super cool. And so I was really interested in, could we get down to the point where we understand so well how DNA is encoding, build this animal this way, that we could look at a strip of DNA and say, okay, what does this turn into? You know, could we get to that level of where we really understand those instructions like it's a piece of code instead of this black box that we're pretending is code and we don't really understand it as code, right? We only understand little pieces of it. And so I studied a whole bunch of different things before I got to this, but snail shells are great because they have that mathematically regular coil, right? So as opposed to a human hand or an eyeball, those things are pretty complex structures. They deform. You know, your hand can make many different kinds of shapes. And how do you measure a hand? Like, how do you summarize all of the shape that a hand entails? But snail shells, you can, you know, they're sort of a generating curve, and you can mathematically break that down into a few parameters. And so it seemed really tractable to me to be able to look at the DNA, modify little knobs, and see what happens to the shell and really be able to mathematically quantify it. And even better, they have a fossil record. So you have this whole history of, so many hundreds of millions of years of evolution to look at how shapes have changed. And now you can experimentally change shape. And so that just seemed like really cool. And there was basically, you know, that wasn't quite why I got hooked on snails, but it turned out it was the perfect system that I'd been waiting for kind of all my life. So sort of a, you know, classic love story. Didn't know what I was looking for until it showed up on my doorstep.
Okay, so what did hook you on snails?
Gosh, am I going to expose your poor audience to this?
Yes.
Okay, I'm gonna tell you, but because it's still the unanswered question that I'm kind of most excited by and nobody is studying. So here's the deal. I was in a class about big evolutionary questions, and it has this reputation for starting people's curiosity and giving, you know, basically giving them a dissertation to walk away with because they're so excited by it. And that's totally what it did for me. And so the the paper we were reading was about this really wacky process that snails do called torsion. And so torsion means twisting, but it's not about the shells twisting. It's about the body that twists. So like all good animals, snails start out head to butt on either end, right? Okay. You know, you've got a head on one side with a mouth where it takes, you know, takes stuff in, and you've got an anus on the back end, and you get rid of waste that way. But then all snails that we've ever studied, you know, all 100,000 plus extant species of snails do this thing where they, during development, they've made a shell, they rotate their back end so that they're like 180 degrees so that their anus is over their head. So they twist like 180 degrees, which makes total sense if you're going to shove your body into a shell and you've only got that one opening. And so you really got to make sure your waist is going out the same, you know, opening so that you're not sort of backing yourself up over time, right? Makes total sense if you have a shell that's okay, coily and twisty like that.
Yes.
However, there are slugs. Slugs exist. These are, you know, snail relatives that their lineages have gotten rid of the shell or internalized it or done something else weird with it. But a lot of times totally got rid of the shell. And so, but all slugs do it too, as far as we can tell. So slugs will start out head to butt, they'll twist, they will kind of untwist and get rid of the shell and then go on with their life. And so I was like, why in, you know, so many hundreds of millions of years of evolution, when you've tinkered with every other part of your body, would you keep this like wacky dance that you do? And so I had the idea that it might be related to, you know, if the first snail that ever was, if the common ancestor of all snails did this twist, you know, you're kind of putting tissues in contact with other parts that wouldn't otherwise be in contact. And so I suspect that like some signal has to be passed on when it's in that configuration. There are two cells or a couple cells that need to see each other and talk to maybe make some organ or to develop your heart. And so if you don't have that connection, you lose a heart and then you die. So that's how you could keep that connection. And so I was always fascinated to understand that process and why it's been kept around so long and what else it influences about the weird snail body. For other reasons, it like people have used that example to talk about evolutionary theory. So there's the question of whether you can, you know, go backwards in evolution or whether it's always kind of forwards. Can you really ever undo something that's been done over evolutionary time? And people use this example a lot for supporting various ideas, but no one's actually studied torsion in a real way. This is like the 1800s. Someone was like, wow, snails turn. And then they kind of unturn maybe. And then they came up with tons and tons of evolutionary theories and no data. So no one's watched how cells move. No one has actually given a description of how a slug like linearizes itself, like untwists. Like no one in the history of ever has studied a slug to tell me how it develops, and it blows my mind. So I'm a big slug champion secretly, and my pet project would be to just like watch a snail develop, watch a slug develop, and see how that works. And they're charming animals. So once I got hooked on snails, you never stop. They're just darling with their little eye tentacles, and some of them modify their foot into wings, and they flap through the water, and it's very cute. Yeah, there's the metal one that exists down on the hydrothermal vents, and it secretes iron onto little scales on its foot, and it looks very metal and badass until you realize the scale bar. It's like the size of, you know, a fist instead of it. The pictures always make it look like it's enormous kaiju sized snail that's covered in metal, but it's very tiny. Yeah, so I got hooked into a lot of cool questions about snails that just aren't getting answered. So
people send you a lot of snail content, I noticed. Whenever anyone says, like, sees a snail thing, they're always like, Darcy, what's this snail? Have you seen this?
Yeah.
Do you get tired of that, or you like bring it on?
No, I'm like bring it on, because occasionally people will not send me that stuff, and then I will find out about it much later and I didn't know it, because there's so much snail mystery out there and there are so many snails, and I don't know, I always love when I get to learn something new about some wacky snail or see a really cool picture. So I'm much more of the bring it on variety. Now, if you want me to answer questions about snails, gosh, I've really only worked with my main snail species, and I'm a total amateur when it comes to anything else. So, like, I can't identify anything for you. When you show me a picture of a snail, I'm like, wow, look at that cute snail. And that is the extent of scientific, enlightenment I can bestow upon you. I'm like, wow, that is some snail. It's real cool.
I feel like I don't know how you resist the temptation to make things up, because, I mean, people would believe you. Like, if you pointed at a snail and you were like, oh, that's the such and such snail, it does this, I'd be like, yeah, oh my gosh. You're totally right.
You're going to turn me into a monster, Alex. I'm going to be the scourge of the scientific community spreading this information.
So when's, like, the snail RPG coming out? Like, I want to LARP this snail life. I want to do this torsion thing.
Right?
I mean, not all aspects of it, but, like, I want to just live this somehow.
Oh, man, and there's so much good stuff about bizarre snail reproduction strategies.
Oh, yeah.
There are love darts. Oh, yeah, there's totally the stacking. Uh-huh. So that's my main species, Crepidula fornicata. They emerge as charming little spaceship larvae, and they're male, and then they settle onto a stack of adults, and they settle and become a male juvenile, and they kind of extend this really long penis down the stack, and they kind of just impregnate up and down the stack, which is crazy.
That's wild.
And then they get big enough and they turn into females. It's really wild. And like I say, they turn into females, but I looked at one this summer and it was totally in between, and I had no idea like how that worked. And so I think there's just so many questions. I don't know. The animal world really puts the gender binary out the window, that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, they're so cool.
Oh, that's so wonderful and exciting.
Yeah, so snail RPG coming out, but it'll be a bit.
It'll be a bit, and it'll be saucy. There will be
yes, it will. There's gonna be ratings. Yeah, you gotta watch out.
Do you want to talk about games? We could talk about games. I mean, I'm happy to make.
Well, this is a snail podcast, but... right? Yeah.
Welcome to Snail Talk. Today, shells. We love them.
Discuss. Excellent.
When it comes to biology and RPGs, actually, are there games or systems or settings where you feel like evolutionary biology is represented really well, or where you get really excited about a setting that involves like animals?
Oh man, that's a great question. I think there are a number that do different aspects of that really well. And I've always found RPGs that give me space to kind of explore what life could look like. I've always found that really valuable as a scientist, because I think we get really stuck in the way of looking at, you know, the animals before us, and we say, oh, well, this is how it must have had to be. This is what life had to become because of the evolutionary process. And there's so much randomness and chance that I think it does us a disservice to not really exercise our creativity and think about other modes of life, especially when we're thinking about maybe life that might emerge on another planet, right? So I guess I want to talk about two games that come to mind immediately. One is what got me really, really deep into gaming about 5 years ago, which is Numenera. So I just joined Monte Cook Games last month as a full-time employee, which is very exciting. But what initially hooked me was it's the setting that's Earth a billion years in the future. There's all sorts of technology that is left behind by these great civilizations of the past. And so you kind of play humans who are plopped back onto Earth or possibly had stuck around in stasis or question mark, but you play humans usually interacting with all of this wild technology and all of these biomechanical creatures and these, you know, these ecosystems, right? Like the writing in the book, it really thinks about what life would evolve around some bit of, like a weird technological facility, right? Or like a whale that is half mechanical, like what could be living inside that and taking advantage of it. And so the kinds of ecosystems and symbioses and animals that would be around there are really evocative. And I think there's a number of scientists on their team. And so they come from a place of being fascinated by the world around us. And I think honestly, the natural world is so weird that as weird as it gets in Numenera in the Ninth World, I think I still get more floored by stuff that is actually out there in our own world. And so I really like that dichotomy, right? We're trying to get as weird as we can in these books. And it is really weird and it's really thoughtful and thought-provoking and neat. But like, so whenever I'm GMing, especially for people new to games, I've run a lot of games for scientists and introduced them to gaming through Numenera because they're, you know, it's a game about discovery. So any scientist is going to want to, you know, ask questions and check stuff out and flip over the beetle and investigate it, right? And what I end up doing a lot of times is putting in real animals or real bits of the natural world into Numenera without really any changes. And it can still, it's really fun to, after a session, be like, wow, that land kraken was really bizarre. And I can tell them, you know, the land kraken isn't a good example because we don't have land kraken yet, but I'm working on it. But like that metal mollusk, right? Like that's a real thing that's very out there. And so it's fun to be able to point people to the weirdness, to reacquaint them to the weirdness of the world around them. So I think that's very powerful. And they have really good illustrators. So the like anatomical sketches and stuff is very, very neat.
I was just going to say actually about the art in Numenera is that it does have this very like, it feels like a very accurate depiction of an animal, even though the animal doesn't exist. Like this is not a real creature, but it has that sort of attention to detail.
Absolutely. Bryn, and her last name starts with an M and I can't pronounce it, but she does a number of those really nice, I think, like it feels like a scientific illustrator sketched it, right?
Yes,
she also does really neat things like shark cats. She had a shark cats calendar one time, so she does like goofy animal-y things, but I think, you know, I've seen some of her sketches and like it's clear that she just has a really good intuition about like to make it seem realistic, right? She's like, she's putting muscle in the right place and she's building up bits of the animal that inform you about what kind of locomotion it has. And so she's just really, she's definitely applying a real scientific anatomical mind to these fictional creatures. And I think that sells it so much for me. And I think that's almost something that I wish scientific illustrators would be better at sometimes. I think there are some, you know, there are a bunch of amazing ones, but you know, especially from like a couple decades ago, there were some rough scientific illustrations where, you know, creativity wasn't applied, right? You were just drawing what was there. And what's missing from this fossil and its bones is the idea that, you know, there may have been soft tissue here or humps or like, you know, a big chunk of muscle. And so that's why like lots of old like museum reconstructions of dinosaurs and stuff look so weird. So I really dig that.
Cool. What was the other RPG?
The other one was Blue Planet. It's a game I finally played after Rich Howard was raving about it forever. And so Rich Howard is my other marine biologist / gamer, like life mate, right? And so we geek out really hard about marine life all the time and RPGs. And he was always telling me about Blue Planet. You gotta read it, Darcy. It's incredible. It's this RPG and setting by Jeff Barber and like Biohazard Games, I think, is the game company. And I think the premise is that it's a little bit in the future of our Earth, and like, you know, Earth's resources were really drying up, and so space travel was looked to for finding a new habitable planet. And they finally discover one, and it's a blue planet. So it's all water. There are no continents, but it's still habitable. It's in the right, you know, temperature. It's got, you know, water, so we can sort of build life there. But there are also all of these animals that have been evolving there, totally independent of us. And so, you know, and Jeff Barber is just a really, really smart, like, you know, he's just very, very informed about the natural world of Earth. And so he's got all these really cool, like he'll get all of like a lot of the technology is like in the world, like the equipment, you go through the equipment guide, right? And you find, oh, here's like a rebreather, but it's using, you know, the little text will have something about like, this is, you know, something we adapted from like flatworms on Earth, right? This is the planarians, this system. Mm-hmm. And so there's all these real scientific details in it that I think make it really sing. And again, give you that sense of like, wow, how weird the world is around us already. But I got to play in a game with him at Gen Con, and the setting was really cool, and there are lots of cool cultural details that he put in there. Like, you know, there's a like station down at the bottom of the ocean, and it's sort of their pristine, you know, flagship station of, oh, hey, we can totally colonize this planet. And so they have like a CSI type show and like a telenovela that's filmed there to sort of promote it. And so that, I don't know, it felt like a really living, breathing world. And he ran, you know, it really stuck with me, not only for the setting information, but that was the first game that's the game that has scared me the most of anything in my life, which is impressive. And I think it's because we thought we were in a charming mystery or an adventure, and it slowly dawned on us over the course of the adventure that it was a horror game we were playing. And it was just a really nice match of like player and character trying to explain away like horrible things that were happening and being like, well, we're not in that kind of game. So it was very cute. So I highly recommend Gaming with Jeff Barber, and anything Blue Planet seems incredible. So I was totally sold on that setting after I played.
Oh man, that sounds so neat. Was there anything else that you got to engage with at Gen Con that was really fun? Congratulations on Industry Insider this year, by the way.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it was really wild and stunning to be up on panels next to people who I, you know, kind of idolized from afar. So that was very special. And I thought I had some really fun conversations there. Okay, big Gen Con highlights. I was kind of all over the place with a little bit of Industry Insider and some little game, you know, games like I was running and working with MCG. What was my other big highlight, I guess? That game really impacted me in a pretty big way. The Ennies were really cool. It was cool to see, I really love what Gnomus Du is doing. And even though I haven't been able to write as much for them lately because dissertation stuff, I think they've really been like, I think a lot of places that are cool voices in the community for games are interested in being a little more inclusive and having more people, more voices on their staff and having more women writing for them and people of color and queer folk. But I think Gnomus Du, the way that their staff approached me, I think they've just really welcomed in a number of different kinds of voices in a very personal way and like not tokenizing it. And so I think a lot of the content that's come out of those hires have been awesome. So obviously not just me, but and so I'm excited to see that crew continue expanding the kinds of voices it brings on and hearing all kinds of different perspectives on advice and topics and opinions in gaming. It was really cool to get so last year they won the Ennie, but I had like just joined. I hadn't even like written an article. So they made me go up there and accept the award, and I felt like the biggest phony in the world. And then this year I had a couple articles under my belt.
Yeah.
And one of the projects that I'm most proud of for Gnomus Du was something that I want to continue doing, and it's Gnome Spotlight. And the idea is that, like, I don't know, there's a lot of negativity in the world, let's say. Let's not draw any lines around that. There's a lot of negativity out there. And I think it's much easier to criticize things that are doing something wrong, in your opinion, than it is to... You know, I think that's kind of, it's an important factor in changing things for the better, but also recognizing good steps towards being better as a person or a company or a product. Like, I just didn't see a place where people were recognizing that quite in the way that I wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
So Gnome Spotlight was a chance for me to say, hey, like, let's talk to this person who's done something kind of above and beyond that's, you know, either like a cool charitable thing, or it's bringing more gamers and making them feel welcome, or, you know, kind of just doing good in the gaming community is sort of what I wanted to highlight. And so I got to have a couple really cool interviews with people I really respect, like Sean Nittner from Big Bad Con, talking about how to make a more inclusive con experience. I thought that was really neat. I'm really proud of that, and I would like to see more of that because I have, you know, there's lots of people doing so much cool stuff that I wish they got more attention to, so more people would be like them, right?
Right, yeah. I can totally understand that, and that's exactly, that's a huge part of why I do this show, right, is
absolutely,
so that I can point at people who are doing really cool stuff and say, yay, yeah, even though often part of that cool stuff is being critical and pointing out like difficult things, you know? But still, like, that's still lifting people up when I,
I think I heard about Big Bad Con through you. So I think that's, I think you started Gnome Spotlight as far as I can tell because of your episode with Sean. Pretty sure.
Yay. I'm so honored. So you were doing industry insider stuff at Gen Con. How was that experience for you?
Yeah, it was. So this year was Gen Con 50. And so I think I get the sense that last year, industry insider, they had some moments to socialize together that weren't really organized this year. And so I didn't actually get to meet most people who were on it. So most of my interaction with it was just the panels. So, you know, it was very brief, really cool, intense, getting to meet a couple people. And, you know, it was nice to feel, I was worried that I wouldn't have a lot to contribute, but I was glad to see that. I think, you know, I've come from a weird enough spot in, you know, I come at things from some unusual positions that I thought were helpful to share on the panels. A lot about like co-creating and co-writing and co-podcasting is something that I'm, you know, like creative works that are done in tandem is really neat for me. So those went well. But yeah, I really wish if I had not been so busy with the other things I was doing, I would have probably tried to, you know, organize an informal get together. Because I would have liked to just meet some more of those people. But it seemed like there was some, you know, good engagement with the audience. So I'm excited to see that program go forward. And it was certainly validating, you know, I got Industry Insider before I was hired by MCG. And so there was a bit of kind of imposter syndrome because I hadn't, you know, I still haven't accomplished that much in our industry. But But that's okay, because you know I'm doing different things from some people. So I think I will continue. I would hope that the cred shined upon me by the Industry Insider program will mean that cool works that I get to support will also get attention from other people. So I think ultimately it will all be good. But yeah, I don't know. I feel a little conflicted about it generally, but yeah. it was a good program, and I'm excited to, you know, go to more of those panels in the future. I wish I could have made more of my own, you know, Industry Insider, like cohorts panels, but alas. Yeah.
That's exactly how I felt last year doing it too, where I was like, oh, this is such a cool opportunity. I am sure that I did not capitalize on it as much as was I could have or was intended or like, And I'm sure that like most people who are doing a program like that are also involved in 10 other things because that's what that's the people that it is for, right? So I was like, okay, I'm also going to do like this one-shot related thing and this games on demand thing and this other thing and this unrelated panel and whatever. It's kind of ironic, I guess.
Yeah, that's actually a little bit of a concern I've had with the Monte Cook Games thing too, right? So I got hired as Monte Cook Games Community Relations Coordinator, which is awesome. So I get to, you know, be social with people and interact with fans, which is already what I want to be doing. And especially as a scientist that have basically been working alone on this snail project for 5 years, like getting to work with people is just a godsend. But also, you know, I can feel myself as I'm trying to get my bearings in this new job, I can feel myself pulling away from a lot of the other activity I was doing. And I'm sure once dissertation stuff is wrapped up, that will get a little easier. But I, you know, it kind of brought up the question. I'm like, okay, so they hired me because, you know, I'm talking to all these people and working involved in all these cool projects that are related to some of their products. So I think I'm doing myself a disservice and them if I don't also make sure I still have that space to kind of engage in that, right? Like I can't just become a robot who just, you know, I think their encouragement has also been like, don't just lose yourself in work. Make sure you're, you know, doing the things you like that keep you passionate. So, but that's something I found I've had to balance. I don't know how you, if you have any experience related to that with your, hires too.
Totally. Right. Because, when games is your passion, that means that it can be like, that's where you go to relax and have fun and like unwind. But then when it's also your job, it can be really hard to figure out how to keep getting both of those things.
I've been joking a lot that because games is now my career, I need to find a new hobby, and that hobby is going to be, and then I like pound my fist into my hand and I say, taking over the Chicago nerd scene, well, not really taking over, but I'm in Chicago and there are all these amazing, cool, nerdy creators here. And I don't feel like we have enough interaction with each other. I feel like it hasn't really been mobilized yet. And I think there are a lot of people who, you know, I did a bunch of Numenera really, really quick like demos at the Adler Planetarium at this like after hours event they had where adults would come and like have cool science themed cocktails and
cool.
You know, do weird science stuff. And so I ran a bunch of Numenera because it's Numenera in space and like 40 people who had never played an RPG before, many of whom didn't even know what it was, like got super into it and enjoyed it so much. So I feel like sometimes I'm really excited to see how we can reach more people and get more gamers into the space and trying it out than we have in the past. I feel like that's kind of my new pet project that's kind of independent from MCG, right? How can I mobilize our nerd community and get more people into their nerdy hobbies?
Oh, that sounds really satisfying, actually. And I've been thinking about that as well, actually, is like what local to me can be sort of developed and cultivated. Ooh, that is satisfying.
Yeah. Do you have any advice yet?
Nope. I will be seeking your advice.
We'll work together. Me.
Oh, that's lovely. I want to hear more about your work with Monte Cook Games because it sounds very exciting and very cool. Please tell me what your interpretation of the community management thing that you do.
Yeah. So I think I'm still carving that space out, you know, and making it Darcy shaped, right? And I have been encouraged to do so. But generally, I'm community relations coordinator, so I'm interacting with fans and retailers. So I'm in charge of our organized play program, which is super cool and kind of in early stages, and so which is really fun for me because I get to maybe tinker with that and see how it can be improved, and I'm excited to have that under my belt. And also our demo team, so which is, again, trying to get new people into gaming. So I'm really, really excited to try out Wacky Darcy ideas to try and get that working. Mm-hmm. And you know, reaching more people, right? So I'm doing lots of that. I am in charge of Monte Cook Games social media. So if you see a lot more exclamation points in our social media in the last month, that's been me. Yeah.
Is fun, actually. Like, that is actually really fun.
It's super fun. I'm really happy. And I guess one thing that I'm kind of excited to really explore and make Darcy shaped is kind of having more of like a Twitch presence. I think we've, you know, at Gen Con, Monte Cook Games puts on a number of panels and seminars, things like that, some of which are, you know, really cool and interactive. So we had like a designing for the Cypher system seminar and like, you know, Bruce Cordell and Shauna Germain were talking about general philosophy about designing a new world for the Cypher system and tuning the mechanics to fit the kind of story you want to tell. And so they jumped around with the audience and kind of built this setting together. But like that, you know, not everyone can afford to go to Gen Con. It's sold out this year. So there's kind of an accessibility issue. And Gen Con is really exhausting, and like cons in general can be really exhausting on our team too. So, you know, finding ways to interact with people who might be in other countries and kind of increasing access to these cool discussions that we get to have at cons is something that I think like Twitch streams and YouTube can really provide. And so I'm kind of excited to tinker around with that and certainly make some gigantic mistakes, I'm sure. But I would like to see kind of Monte Cook Games like interacting with their fans over that way and getting some of these cool, like slightly one-on-one interactions with the design team, with people from all over. Right. So that's something that excites me. And, I don't know, like I'm just fascinated by the tools that things like Twitch provide in terms of like getting that like FaceTime with the fans, right? I think I always appreciate that when I feel listened to and feel like I can make the creator's day by saying like, hey, I love that thing you made. So I feel like it's a really cool tool for both the creative side and sort of the people who are fans of that creative.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny. I was actually just seeing Adam Coble was tweeting about this yesterday saying like, hey, like people who make RPGs, like get in touch with us and talk to us and work with us. Like, if we like your stuff, we want to promote it.
Oh, and, yay.
You know, there's a lot to be sort of mutually like done there. And from what I can see, kind of seeing both sides of that equation, like there's so many people making RPGs who just have no concept of like, what's a Twitch? Like, yeah. How do I get my thing on the computer TV? Like, I don't know. And I'm not trying to be salty. Like,
no, no.
Understand. Like, it's genuinely very confusing and like, it's a very new medium.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, I've really been thinking about like, how do we open up the lines of communication between like people making stuff and people promoting stuff on Twitch?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in podcasts and on YouTube as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, like when I don't have time to game, like podcasts have been a really great way for me to feel like connected to the community and continue mulling over cool RPG ideas in my head and keeping engaged with the people I like too, right? Because I get to hear them talking or and so I don't know. I think all these different kinds of media are ways to help continue reaching out to people who want to be engaged with this weird creative world that we're in and don't have a chance to. So I'm really supportive of it that way. And I wonder, so I, you know, I'm one of those people saying, how do I make the people talk on my TV sort of with respect to Twitch? So I'm also hoping, you know, maybe on Gnome Stew or something, as I sort of figure out what works for Montecook Games, I'm hoping that I will compile all of my raving notes into something useful for people. I'm sure there are guides out there, but I haven't really found one that is thinking about, you know, I haven't found a great one yet that's like RPG specific, thinking about actual plays and things like that. And it may exist out there, but I have not found it yet. So
I feel like you and I are going to have to collaborate on this because we're the people looking for it. And if neither of us have found it, I feel like that means no one has written it.
We should go fill that space and do the work so that... Yeah. We don't have to have people doing the same unproductive search that we've been doing.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Oh, that's really cool. You know what? The last thing I want to ask you about, I was going through some of the stuff that you got to speak about at Gen Con, and something that stuck out to me was the GM advice for women by women panel. Someone once told me that every panel is the GM advice panel eventually. It will always go that way, whether or not you want it to.
Uh-huh.
So that amuses me. But also, I would not be very motivated to attend a GM advice panel, but this really intrigued me.
Mm.
What kinds of questions came up and what were some of the responses?
Oh, it was, I wasn't sure what to expect. I mean, some amazing organizers. So Michelle McFarland and Sarah Richardson were kind of my co-panelists and organizers. And, you know, they're incredible people with great advice generally. So that was, you know, it was going to be successful no matter what because they were on it. But we had a room packed full of people, totally filled the space. And I was really intrigued to see that it wasn't all... you know, there were a lot of kind of mail passing people and it seemed to be a pretty diverse crowd in terms of who came. I wasn't sure if we would just get, you know, people who identify as women I wasn't sure who we would get. And it was cool to see that we seemed to get a pretty diverse crowd. And what I really liked about this panel, and I'm still trying to figure out what the conditions were that created this, but it felt much more like a conversation with like 45 people. Like this beautiful conversation. I'm not sure exactly how many, but like on the order of magnitude that many. And it just felt really, like a really natural, productive, informative conversation. I felt like us panelists learned a lot and, you know, we put our two cents in, but it was really nice to see a good back and forth happening. It definitely didn't last long enough for how good the conversation was. But some of the things we were talking about were really cool. One of the things that surprised me, I think I was talking about this with Michael Ross on RPG Academy the other day. So talking about, you know, worrying about people at your table and like women who might be socialized to not speak up as fast as the men are socialized to do, which is something that I really struggled with in science and in RPGs. And so you can get those like female voices can not get as much airtime as they may be trying to get because of that dynamic. But kind of the flip of that came up that I thought I had definitely experienced. So like one person was like, I GM a game. I'm a woman. I GM a game. And I've noticed that my boyfriend is in the game and I keep unintentionally kind of passing over him to, you know, kind of overcompensating for favoritism, right? And it was actually an experience that a number of us had. Like, I had definitely done it. And, you know, not just boyfriends, but people I trust, too. And so it was kind of this fun, like, extrapolation of the problem of how we, like, split up that, like, spotlight and screen time. And I don't know. It was just the dynamics that came in that were kind of gendered or relationship related were really, really cool. And so some of the solutions we thought of for that were, you know, just so in case anyone else had this problem and doesn't know how, I think like having a little like checkbox of some sort and kind of noting mm-hmm. how often people have spoken up. So Jim McClure does that 8 kinds of fun thing, right? That he tells me about, where he's looking around his table and he makes a little matrix and it's the person's name and then the 8 kinds of fun, whatever they are. And he's like making little tick marks to note when they're engaged in different kinds of fun. And that helps him like understand them. But I think it also helps you make sure you're watching for each player and constantly questioning like, hey, how are they doing at my table right now? So I don't know. There were a bunch of good questions, but that was, you know, they were just of a different level than I've gotten in other panels, I think.
Definitely. And that sounds like a very care-oriented question as well.
Yes.
Right?
Good
if people
point.
Are asking questions not about like, how can I entertain, delight, scare, whatever my players, but like, you know, empower them to look out for themselves or to look out for each other. That's a very interesting dynamic. I think I would have enjoyed that conversation a lot.
Yeah, I'm hoping they do it again. I think you should go be a panelist on it. I would love to hear what you'd have to say.
Well, awesome. We should have that.
We should
have that discussion.
Yeah.
Well, before we wrap up, I don't know. Is there anything? Gosh, I'm trying to think if there's anything like really exciting and like super cool that's happening right now that maybe you might want to mention for my
Is
audience.
This leading? Well, yeah, there's, you know, and I think it's fitting for it to come at the end because I think there's sort of this circular nature of the way I've interacted with my passion in the gaming hobby, right? So the big exciting news that's going to be happening when this comes out is that Numenera, the game that I found 5 years ago at Gen Con, I got in on a demo and it blew my mind for many, many, many reasons. Setting, the mechanics, and the way I was asked to contribute to the narrative. So lots of good things. And it inspired me to be a GM for the first time. So it's, and you know, and it's just sort of cascaded into all these friendships I have that have really changed me. So I owe a lot to Numenera generally, as silly as that may seem. And now that I think it's really helped me become part of this big community. And I think it's really interesting that right now Monty Cook Games is kickstarting Numenera 2, but it's not like a totally new edition because everything's compatible with the new like core book that's coming out. But what it's doing is it's like expanding the kinds of tools and resources available to you to not just be about looking to the past and exploring these amazing ruins and technologies of the ancients, but it's about taking those resources and it's about looking forward with it, right? It's, you've got a world that's dealing with all the dangers of the ninth world and all of the war machines that are left behind and dealing with how do we find water? How do we, you know, different areas will have different problems. And so Numenera 2 is really about empowering tables and players to tell really interesting stories about building a better future. And I just think it's the perfect time in the world right now to be thinking about that. Like, you know, there's always lots of sad things going on, but I don't know. I feel like it's going to be kind of a big light in my darkness anyway, which I'm very excited by. And it's also, it feels appropriate, right? That like, I'm the new community relations coordinator and like, Numenera 2 is about building better communities and cultivating and helping people out and solving, you know, conflicts people have and like building a better future. So I don't know. I just feel like I'm really, really lucky to be coming on at this time. Like that just feels like I'm really excited to be able to contribute to that product. I think that's going to be really, really powerful for people. And I know I'm going to get a lot of fun out of it. So I think it's just, I don't know. It just feels very serendipitous, I guess. And so the Kickstarter, at the time of this podcast, it will be out for probably maybe at least another week, I think, probably. But, so check it out. It means a lot to me personally. And it's really cool. Like the people who I have joined with Monty Cook Games, like they, you know, this isn't a cash grab. This is a really special, thoughtful, like, move that they're making. And it's the kind of game, the kind of stories, and the kind of experiences they want to empower people to have to kind of get something really positive and powerful out of their games. And I don't know, I'm really excited for it.
Oh, that's awesome. Your enthusiasm is beautiful and shining, and it's got me right now. It's completely
got me. I'm so glad. Yeah, good.
Oh, yay.
Yay.
Well, gosh, thank you so much for joining me today. This was extremely fun.
Thank you so much. This was fabulous.
Yay. People should go they should go check out Monte Cook Games, but they should also go and see what you're up to at Gnome Stew. Listen to the Cypher Speak podcast. How's that going these days?
Good. So my PhD troubles kind of caused us to have a hiatus, but we're back in full force, and podcasting with my podner Troy Pitchelman is keeping me super happy and sane and rooted, and I feel like we have lots to say, and I'm really excited to do more of the interviews with the community, right? So there are a lot of cool voices doing interesting things in Cypher, in the Cypher world, and I think our podcast is going to be able to amplify those voices, so I'm really excited.
Heck yeah, amplifying voices of those who you think are doing cool work. I relate. Right? I relate to this.
Exactly.
Awesome. Is there anywhere else where people can see what you're up to and keep up with you?
Yeah. Twitter, at Darcy L. Ross, is kind of the easiest place to find me. And I should say, although I've fallen a little bit away from it just because of dissertation chaos, Contessa is an organization I have some involvement with that's super cool. So we can't get into it today too much. But they used to be an organization that was about supporting and highlighting women in games and just calling attention to the people, the women who are already doing cool stuff in gaming. And this past year, they've expanded to support, you know, if you identify as coming from some kind of group that's marginalized, like, we want to support you too. And this year at Gen Con was the first year where they sort of opened their doors. And I think it was really successful and powerful and meaningful to a lot of people. So I'm really excited to see where they go further with that. And I'm hoping I'll be able to get involved again once fires get put out in my life.
Right. When the great dissertation has been slain.
Yeah, exactly.
Can I tell you a cool story?
Please.
I was at the Pelgrane booth this Gen Con, and at one point, a small child came up. I want to say like 10. I'm very bad at guessing these things. But anyway, she was adorable, and she had a Contessa t-shirt on. And I said, I pointed at her, I said, hey, you're running anything? And she said, yes. She said, yep. She's going to go run No Thank You Evil later.
Oh, my gosh.
And I was like, yes, please come back and tell me how it went, because I want to hear everything. And oh my gosh. I'm so excited for you. And yeah, so I got it was a very exciting moment. So that's my cool,
that's amazing
story.
Yeah. Oh, that's so good. I got to co-run a game of Numenera last year at Gen Con with a 12-year-old, and it was incredible. So
rad as hell.
Yeah, I'm so pumped to see, you know, the upcoming generation of gamers. It's it's going to be a good time.
Oh, yay. Okay, perfect. Awesome, inspiring note to end on.
Yeah.
Well, huge thanks to Darcy for coming on the show, and as always, thank you for listening. If you have thoughts on today's episode, you can always email me, that's backstorypodcast@gmail.com, or you can tweet at me, @backstorycast. Backstory is part of the One Shot Podcast Network. You can find more great shows at oneshotpodcast.com. like Campaign, One Shot, Modifier, Neo Scum, System Mastery, Adventure, Warda, more and more all the time. Music for Backstory is provided by Ujiko. The track is called Thinking of You, and you can hear more at soundcloud.com/UJICO. Talk to you later, heroes.